The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dungshan's Five Ranks teaching. The first rank, the apparent within the realm. In the third watch of the night before the moon appears, no wonder when we meet there's no recognition. Still cherished in my heart is the beauty of earlier days. So, kia ora, New Zealand students. You know, even almost 15,000 miles away, when I was doing Doksan this morning, I heard the next student running up the stairs, and I knew it was Suido. And it was. Those imprints go deep. They told me that, Kusho in New Zealand told me that they have a, if I'm seeing them, so that as they're sitting, that they have the visual of course, their own space, your own space, and also this space, which the word on the street is quite powerful. This teaching by Master Dungshan, the five ranks, there are various teachings in many in Buddhism, Mahayana Buddhism, and particularly in the Zen tradition, that are really looking at the relationship between these two aspects of reality, the absolute and relative, the real and the phenomenal, the ultimate and the conventional. They're phrased in different ways. And oftentimes there's a kind of intellectual framework that these teachings are sort of built on. And in that way, they can be off-putting because they're also difficult to understand. And particularly when people are practicing and stuff's going on, you know, there's something very sort of strong or compelling in your life that is of your life. It can be hard sometimes to appreciate these teachings. They can seem remote or abstract or intellectual or somehow not about you, which is unfortunate. And that it perhaps just takes a certain amount of time and study to see how profoundly they are about you. In essence, how do we live in this world with things? I mean, in a sense, it all comes down to that. How do we live in this world with things? There are internal things. There are external things. We call them objects. We call them people. We call them emotions. We call them histories. We have all kinds of names for them, but in a sense, it all comes down to the same thing. How do we live with the things of the world? Peacefully. Joyfully. Which is just another way of saying, how do we live in an ongoing state of relatedness, profound relatedness, interdependent relatedness. When that very relatedness seems to be at the center of every conflict, there is. There is no conflict apart from you and something. Right? Try and find one. Conflict doesn't even make sense without someone being in conflict with something. So how do we do that? And so what the Buddha was enlightened to, he was liberated directly to that in his enlightenment. And in a sense, over these more than 2,500 years, the teachings have began with the Buddha and in a state of profound sophistication, but then also evolved throughout the history of Buddhism and on into the different traditions of Buddhism, like the Mahayana tradition, the Prajnaparamita teachings. And so, we are aware of everything that we can see and understand with our senses. But usually, just in coming to Buddhist practice, we have some sense that there is something more that is not, that is unseeable, unknowable in some way, that can't be measured. It's not just another thing that's going to be added up somewhere, that there's some other realm. Everything that we see, all of these things, appear in some form. They have some form of existence. They seem to exist on their own. But we encounter the teachings, and then we begin to encounter directly ourselves that is not the fact. In fact, nothing exists that way. And so when we come into this hall, as all of us do, whether it's this hall or it's your place in New Zealand or your place at home, but we encounter the teachings and we chant the Heart Sutra and our words form the phrase, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. And the sutra goes on, and it goes on into images and poetic expressions. But what have we just said? What just came out of our mouth? You and I are one nature, but we're clearly different. A sense of self arises, but the teachings say that the self is selfless. How are we to understand this? And more importantly, how does our understanding radically transform? Not just our understanding, but our experience of everything. In other words, this whole question about how do we live in the world of things, is that even the right question? Or if it is the right question, what do we presuppose about ourselves and about things? And so we come into practice and we are shown to our seat and we're given instruction. It's sort of like, you know, we come in eager, hungry, sincere, seeking, and someone gives us some simple instruction that we can understand and then shows us to our seat. But really, if you lifted the veil, what they've done is taken us to a precipice and they just pushed us off. We don't know it yet. And so we begin our practice in the world we live in that world of things. And we sit down on this diamond seat and we begin to encounter them, one by one. And they seem to just have no end. They proliferate. They are profuse and varied. But in time, with sincere practice, things begin to happen. There's a kind of settling that begins to take place in the mind, amongst these many things, in our reaction to them, in this body, within our sort of energetic fields, and more subtly, in the ways that this mind is creating thingness, objects, around that phenomena that arises. That sense of the mind creating a sense of distance begins to shift. That distance begins to collapse. The ongoing sort of machinery of our identity making, of appropriating experiences, negative or positive, and integrating them into this sense of ourself. That begins to be actually seen. We begin to actually see that taking place. So this kind of abstract notion or perhaps superficial notion of identity begins to take on more and more depth, more profound understanding. And as our mindfulness develops, that leads into a state of what the Buddha called right concentration or right samadhi. And extremely powerful natural aspect of the mind, in which all of that diffusion and distraction and dispersion and scattering begins to be gathered into one focused attention. And that samadhi more readily opens the door to what we call insight, seeing. Seeing something we have not seen before. And even the word seeing, this is where language just fails. Because even the notion of seeing, it's not in the eyes, and it's not subject and object. There's an experience, but even that, it's like we don't even know how to speak of it without the distance. We don't have words that actually can say it without in those very words creating a sense of distance and self and other. It's like if the slightest distinction separates heaven and earth, that which is inseparable, then how is it when there is no distinction? If we see more and more that, more clearly, that how the mind creates worlds within worlds within worlds, well, then we should naturally want to know how is it when the mind stops creating such a world? What world remains? And so it says, when the thought objects vanish, the thinking subject vanishes. And that's what this first rank of Master Dungshans is speaking to. So this is one of the ways, a very powerful and prominent way within the Zen tradition, that this teaching on this relationship between these two essential aspects of reality, we call them the absolute and the relative. The absolute is that realm in which there is no distinguishing characteristic. There is no characteristic at all. The thinking subject and the object have vanished. There is no characteristic or quality or time or space, no body, no thing. The mind has ceased to produce, has ceased to create worlds. And then there is the world of worlds, where there are many things, the world we live in, the world we talk about. We draw pictures of it, write poems about it, get in fights over it. And so in this first rank, the apparent within the real, the poem says, in the third watch of the night, before the moon appears, utter darkness, nothing can be seen. No wonder when we meet, there's no recognition. It's like a moonless, starless night. Nothing is seen, nothing is known, no one is watching. It is not a time, it's not a place, it's not a state, it's not a consciousness. The mind of the great sage of India was intimately conveyed from west to east. Among human beings, we can speak of wise ones and fools, but in the way, there is no northern or southern ancestor. There is no up or down, before and after, right or wrong. It is the realm of non-production. Nothing is being created. Now, it's hard to, or in fact impossible, to conceive of such a thing, because in our conception, we are producing. So we cannot create something uncreated by creating it. But in thinking of this absolute ground of being, this absolute basis, we have images like in the third watch of the night, utter darkness, empty space, the vast sky, the boundless ocean. But those are just images. They are just metaphors. That's all. Here, there are no wise ones, no deluded ones, no northern or southern ones, no monastics, no lay, no suffering, no cause of suffering. This is the basis of cease from all harm. Ceasing from harm at its ultimate is not just being so adept at not harming that we don't create any, but rather realizing that the fundamental in the fundamental ground there is no harming. And so, the poem says, no wonder when we meet there's no recognition. The 10,000 things return to the one. The student is entered into the principle, the real, the unconditioned. But that is just a way of speaking. No one arrives here. And no action has caused this. And yet without practice, it's very unlikely to occur. Master Hakuin spoke about each of these ranks. And in speaking of them as ranks, there's the natural sense that, you know, this is sort of the beginning stage, it's the lowest, and then you reach the highest. In one sense, there is a kind of progression to the path that these ranks describe. But in another sense, and importantly, each is its own state, each is its own reality, each is its own perspective, you might say. But more than perspective, each is its own experience. And all of this is in service to the final, the where it's all leading, which is unity, complete integration. And so it's really describing how does that actually happen in spiritual practice, in this practice, in Buddhist practice, in our practice. How does that actually happen? You know, we tend to think if we just have an experience, you know, a big, important experience, that somehow everything is going to be seen, everything is going to be clarified, everything is going to be let go, everything is going to be perfect. There's a reason why, since the beginning, there has been training rather than just practice to have an experience and then pick up your things at the door. Because it is much more than that. Even having an experience, a person can have such an experience and, in a certain sense, not be able to live it. Not be able to apply it, certainly not be able to understand it in such a way that we need to so that we can really live it fully. And by understanding, I don't just mean conceptually. So Master Hakuin, but at the same time, with many of these stages, as is true with so much of spiritual practice, is because, you know, our capacity to attach, to objectify, and then to attach to something is pretty limitless, right? That we have to be alert and sort of alerted to all of the ways in practice that we will almost certainly start to do exactly that. And so Master Hakuin is sort of our warning coach here. So he calls to us in just such a moment and says, above, there is not a tile to cover your head. Below, not an inch of ground for you to stand on. The delusive passions are non-existent. Enlightenment is non-existent. Samsara is non-existent. Nirvana is non-existent. This is the state of total empty solidity. And by solidity, he means all-pervasiveness. Without sound, without smell, like a bottomless clear pool, it is as if every fleck of cloud had been wiped from the vast sky. The turning mind, the creating mind, has come to rest. Naturally. And that's very important to understand. This is not a matter of control. It cannot be taken by force. It is the original mind, in a sense, returning to its original place. Seeing how the mind is ceaselessly creating worlds and identities in past, present, and future, how is it when it ceases? You know, another way of looking at this is to flip it around. So in a moment that is not going well for you, take your pick. It'll apply. That is not going well for you, check in and see the state of your mind, in particular, your thoughts. Because you will have some. You will be thinking. They go together. And so what is that showing us? That when we're in distress, right, when we are suffering, when suffering is being created, the mind is very busy. So if we really see that, then doesn't that make us want to know, well, what's on the other side of that? And again, you know, we might think, well, that's all well and good, but, you know, that's very abstract, and like, I've got a problem here, right? There's something going on here that I need to deal with, that I'm upset about. Something is happening, and that may very well be true. But what the Buddha realized is that if we continually see and understand and respond to that in the old way, the same thing will just keep happening. In other words, if we just see it in the way, only way we know how to see it, even bringing in different perspectives, right? Conceptual perspectives can help, but the basic structure is still there. And so to say, well, the fundamental basis of this very moment, of your distress, is empty of that very distress, that can just feel like a slap across the face, as though it's denying your experience, which it is not, not even for a moment. But there's a point at which we are tired enough or eager enough or desperate enough that we want to know, is there another possibility at this very moment that isn't just changing the conditions, isn't just rearranging people? Do I actually have access to a kind of power or mind or awareness that is actually liberating? But Hakuin says, too often the disciples, considering that their attainment of this rank is the end of the great matter, and their discernment of the Buddha way is complete, clings to it to the death and will not let go. This is called dwelling in stagnant water. You know, I've met people over the years. They don't usually stick around very long. But I've met people who come in so tenaciously clinging to an experience that they have had that they are convinced is enlightenment, which means they are enlightened, and you cannot wrestle that away from them. Meanwhile, their life is not going so well. There is not integration. And so Hakuin says, therefore, as long as one remains in this hiding place of quietude and passivity and vacantness, inside and outside appear transparent and your understanding seems perfectly clear. But the moment your bright insight comes into contact with differentiations, defiling conditions of turmoil and confusion, agitation and vexation, love and hate. In other words, the moment you get off the cushion, it may not even take that long. We will find ourselves utterly helpless before all of this and in all of the mysteries of existence as before. Right? And we can see aspects of this, you know, very early in training, all along the way, where we cling to certain experiences of meditation where our mind was particularly quiet, where the body was exquisitely relaxed, or we finally let go of something that we've been holding on to, and there's a genuine sense of release and expansiveness and relief. And all of those experiences are true and real and important and are signs that our practice is developing. That's not the issue. The issue is wanting to preserve them. And in a sense, that's the same impulse that Hakuin is talking about here. And so real spiritual training is, as the old teacher said, for the road, giving you strength for the road. It's too easy and understandable why people seek spiritual practice as an escape, right? That seems like a good strategy. If you can just escape from this, but at this point, self-nature is not yet clear, and the nature of others is not yet clear. Looking closely, we see that they're still grasping, and that's why the poem says, still cherished in my heart is the beauty of earlier days. Still cherishing, still looking back, still looking outward. But that's normal, right? That's normal. Those tendencies are very strong. They're not just relinquished in this one experience. There's a koan where Yan Yang came to Master Zhaozhou and says, how is it when nothing arises in my mind? And Zhaozhou said, cast it off. And Yan Yang says, when nothing arises, how can I cast it off? And Zhaozhou said, well then, carry it with you. We can carry anything, even the idea of nothing. And so continuing on, we come to the real within the apparent. And so that experience of absolute emptiness, of not a single thing, but what does that have to do with the things of the world? Because as Hakuin has said, that becomes just stagnant water. When we encounter the things of the world, differentiations, defiling conditions, Hakuin says, we will be thrown around. We will not have that strength for the road. We will not be able to draw upon that in such a way that will help us. And so the second rank is the real within the apparent, the ultimate within the conventional. And the poem says, a sleepy-eyed old woman encounters herself in an old mirror. Clearly she sees a face, but it doesn't resemble hers at all. Too bad, with a muddled head, she tries to recognize her reflection. And so here, to realize that the fundamental nature of all things is empty, the real, within the apparent, the absolute within the relative, emptiness of all phenomena, everything, teachings, dharmas, experiences, insights, tragedies, memories, emotions, bridges, everything. And here she's sleepy-eyed, not yet fully awake, not yet fully have cast off the veil. But everywhere she looks, she sees her face. Having realized her nature, everywhere she looks, she sees this self-nature in everything. All things have one flavor, one taste, one nature. And so here, seeing self-nature, seeing other nature, the same, like meeting for the first time, realizing that everywhere, in everything, there is just one community, one world, one essence. That's why these images and metaphors of the ocean and the sky, things that are boundless and undifferentiated. You know, if somehow we could just will ourselves to experience this, if we could just know this with our intellect somehow, the world might be a very different place. As I said the other day, because it is so very simple, unadorned, uncontrived, unproduced, because it is so very close, never apart, it's difficult to see. It is so difficult to trust that. And even if we do, and as we do, our mind is still just so conditioned, so engineered to be constantly and subtly looking and creating something apart. And so this image of the mirror, she encounters herself in an old mirror, the mirror of samadhi, the mirror of Buddha mind that perfectly reflects everything. It has no agenda, it has no opinion, it has no history, it can't be corrupted, you can't take it over, you can't make it bend to your will. It's just the mirror. It just fulfills its nature. It just reflects. It shows whatever stands before it perfectly. Adding nothing, subtracting nothing. Myriad forms, one face, infinite waves, one ocean. And if we speak of unity or sameness or identity or oneness, all of those fall short because they all suggest that we're taking two things and we're uniting them. Because in our ordinary way of thinking, that's kind of the closest we can get. Like, how does something merge? Well, you take two things that are different and you merge them. And then they become one thing. But it's not that. There is no becoming, no merging, no joining, no integrating. And so even when we speak of merging with the breath, that's just words. Or merging with the koan, that's just pointing language. Language that is intended to point. It's like everything returns to its nature. Form makes the character and appearance different. Sounds distinguish comfort and discomfort. The dark makes all words one. In that non-differentiation, all words are the same. In brightness, when the sun comes out, we see good and bad, right and wrong. But more and more in this rank, and as we continue, the four elements return to their nature as a child to its mother. Fire is just hot. Wind moves. Water is wet. Earth is hard. Your eyes see. Your ears hear. Just that. There is nothing apart from that. And in that, it is complete. But, too bad, with a muddled head, she tries to recognize her reflection. Still trying to understand, to relate, to describe, to identify, to know. Right? I mean, how many times have you had an experience and then immediately get to work at how am I going to tell so-and-so about this? Right? Already it's becoming a story. Which is one reason, you know, I say now and then how important it is to be aware of not just the power of language, but when we talk about our practice, particularly when we talk about important things in practice, experiences, be careful. Because in that, something is changing in your mind. Still trying to understand, not yet falling freely with no ground below and only sky above. That persistent underlying desire to have, to hold, to possess, to claim, to be. And again, it's normal. You know, even the sense of relative and absolute. I think Shohaku Roshi talked about this on Sunday. I mean, it's all throughout the teachings. Then in talking about relative and absolute, we tend to rank them. So relative is like, you know, kind of sucks, kind of have to deal with it. But the absolute's where it's at, right? Free and clear, right? Heaven forever, right? And that's not true. That's not correct. These are not ranked. They're two aspects of one thing. It's like saying waves are better than the ocean, or the ocean is more important than the waves. I mean, what kind of argument is that? And so it's very important that we appreciate that and keep remembering that. You know, an aspect of that is that the self is clearly wrong and selflessness is clearly right. But those are just different expressions of this very thing, of this very teaching. The self arising is the realm of the phenomenal. Selflessness is the direct encounter with the absolute. Both are essential. Both are part of one complete entity or wholeness. And so Hakuin says, if the disciple had remained in that earlier rank, their judgment would always have been vacillating and their view prejudiced. Therefore, the bodhisattva of great vow. So remember, this is the whole point. This is the bodhisattva path. Right? How might we hope to bring compassion into this world, to stand in the face of suffering and be able to see it and understand it and be skillful in the presence of it, without understanding its nature? And if we don't understand its absolute nature, then we will inevitably always get caught up in what we call its relative its aspects, its characteristics. And isn't that exactly what we get entangled in, is the characteristics of things, how they appear to us, how they feel, the way they impact us, all of those qualities. It's not that they're wrong or that they're not true, but they're to only know that is to only be able to know that and respond on the basis of that. In experiencing the fundamental nature, now we know that in the midst of those qualities and characteristics, that their basic nature is not as they appear, while they appear. And so Hakuin says, therefore the bodhisattva of great vow invariably leads their daily life in the realm of the six dusts. the dusts that come in through our six senses, the realm of all kinds of ever-changing differentiation, all the myriad phenomena before your eyes, the old and young, honorable and base, halls and pavilions, verandas and corridors, plants and trees, mountains and rivers. You regard all of this as your original, true, and pure aspect. It's like looking into a bright mirror and seeing your own face. And then he says something very important, because in that sense, he's just reporting. And then he says, if now you continue for a long time to observe everything everywhere with this radiant insight, all appearances of themselves become the jeweled mirror of your own house. Master Dogen has said the experiencing of the manifold dharmas through using oneself is delusion. The experiencing of oneself through the coming of the manifold dharmas is satori, is enlightenment. Hakuin says, this is just what I've been saying. If we continue for a long time to observe everything everywhere with this understanding, and that is so important, again, because we can treasure this notion that if I just have the right experience, I'm done. We're done. It's done. That very notion, that way of thinking, is the way of thinking that binds us. But what this also clearly points to is that the habits and the views persist and that practice must continue. In a sense, we've realized that each thing has its own essential nature, but we have not yet understood how it relates to everything else in function and position, drawn from the identity of relative and absolute. We have not yet seen that. And without that, we're still on wobbly ground. And so that means we continue practicing and training. We continue coming back to this seat. We continue going back into our zazen and letting it deepen and deepen and deepen. And if we really want to be powerful and really use our time well, then we really must continue all of that off the cushion. You know, that's part of the whole dualistic mindset, on, off. Go to work during the week, kick back during the weekend. Right? Zazen's where you do your work, then you take a little break. Come back, do some work, then you take a little break. Do a bit of work, take a lot of breaks. Right? And then we wonder, why isn't my practice, why is it fragmented? Why isn't my meditation coming with me off the cushion? You must bring it. It's really just that simple, right? And it's very challenging. But the practice of it is not difficult. And so in the subsequent talks, I realized for you folks in New Zealand, because you're going to be ending Sesshin, tomorrow's your last full day, I'll be leaving you with a bit of a cliffhanger here, right? So you can't get stuck here, right? So you have to listen to the other talks. So I'll take up the other aspects of this so that we can see how does this progress. And drawing from that poem, reading words, Chi Dao said, you should grasp the great reality. In every moment, do not judge by any standards. Free your mind. If you don't see the way, then you simply don't see it even as you're walking on it, as you're sitting in it, as you are it. When you walk the way, it's not near, it's not far. Although when we're deluded, it can seem mountains and rivers away from ourselves. And so I respectfully say to those who wish to be enlightened, do not waste your time by night or day. To really understand how fortunate we are to be alive and to be here and to have enough sanity and well-being and peace and capacity to be here practicing and to be here together. We shouldn't take that for granted. And so let's really use this time that we have. You know, when we really practice wholeheartedly, like for this session, and we think, okay, I'm really going to throw myself into it because this session doesn't last that long and I'm really going to engage it. And then what we begin seeing is we could keep doing that. Isn't that the point? We could actually keep practicing that way with a different intensity, of course, in different conditions as we return home, of course. But that level of commitment, of love, of faith, right? We've just shown ourselves that we can bring that forward, and we've also seen what happens when we do. We shouldn't waste that either. Don't not see that. Do see it.
Thanks for listening. Looking for in-person practice opportunities? With the easing of pandemic quarantine restrictions, Zen Mountain Monastery and the Zen Center of New York City are once again open for group meditation, services, residency, and retreats. We'll continue to offer online programs to our Sangha near and far, even while we host more in-person events for all those able to travel. You can find all upcoming activities listed on our website, zmm.org.